This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
America beyond capitalism, reclaiming our wealth, our liberty, and our democracy with Gar Alpovitz.
We turn our attention to another facet of occupying Wall Street, or the question of wealth and its distribution. As discontent with the economic and political status quo mounts in the wake of the Great Recession, Gar Alpervitz's America Beyond Capitalism suggests a bottom-up effort already underway in communities across the U.S., which point in the direction of, among other things, worker-owned cooperatives and community land trusts supported by policies and resources from municipal, state, and federal government.
Ongoing economic pain is likely to continue to inspire such initiatives to demand further action to democratize the ownership of capital so that ownership goes to the 99% in new ways rather than to the top 1%. We're joined by Gar Alpovitz, professor of political economy and co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative and author of America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy.
Glad to be with you.
And Gar, I'm really glad to have this discussion on Beyond Capitalism, because I think that we need to talk about what we want or what we may want in the future in this way. And one of the things that I wanted to start off with is worker co-ops. And I know that you've mentioned that there are many more of those in the country than at least I had thought before, but you mentioned especially a focus on those in Cleveland, and you talk about that as a model. So why don't we start off with that model of the Cleveland cooperatives?
It's a very interesting model, and it's we can talk about it because it's the development over time from many, many experiences in Ohio and elsewhere that are part and parcel of a developing momentum for increasingly refined and sophisticated worker-owned co-ops. The complex in Cleveland that's on the ground now is in a very poor black neighborhood of about average income of about $18,000 a year. So it's very low income. On the other hand, in that same area, there are gigantic hospitals, university buildings, and so forth in the same area, so-called anchor institutions. They don't get up and leave communities. And that's relevant for anybody listening, because many communities have these anchor institutions, and often there's a lot of public money in them, healthcare money, education money. So one of the questions is, could we use that focus in a different way? And in Cleveland, that's just what's happened. So a group of worker co-ops have been set up, and they're not separate. They're linked together in with a kind of non-profit corporation. This is not designed to make a few rich workers. It's designed to build up the community as well as the workers. So it's worker-owned co-ops linked together with a non-profit corporation and also a revolving fund, so that when they make profits, about 10% goes back to the revolving fund, the loan fund, in order to start new co-ops. And the idea is to build a whole complex, not just a couple small co-ops. And these aren't small co-ops. So let me give you an idea of what's already on the ground. And they're developing, they think, 2 to 4 a year on this same model. One of them is a hydroponic greenhouse with solar heating as a substantial part of it. But the scale of it is this: 3 million heads of lettuce a year, plus other things. So it's a really significant scale operation. There's a solar installation company, worker-owned company, as part of this complex. They're on track to be putting in more solar installation over the next year than exists in the entire state of Ohio. And part of it's going onto the roofs of these hospitals and universities as part of the market.
Gar, let me just, if I may, sure. Does this particular model also have a union for the workers? And if it does, if you could explain how the two entities really kind of coexist. And if it doesn't, how has this really become a democratization experience for the workers?
So far, these companies do not have unions. You know, they're not that large in the sense. In terms of democratization, it is direct one person, one vote on the board of control of the companies. But there are other worker-owned companies that are worker-owned plus unions. So that model exists, too. And I think we're going to see a whole variety of different mixes of these structures. You probably know the U.S. steelworkers are now trying to set up worker-owned companies, too, starting from the union end. And this is part and parcel of what America Beyond Capitalism is about, this kind of bubbling up of new forms of ownership starting in different places with different mixes of control. But these are very democratic operations. They're very not huge institutions. The workers elect their own guys to put them on the board and make the decisions. They hire management, but the management is subject to the recall by the workers. So these are one person, one vote operations. They may get to the point where they want to add a union, but that hasn't been the immediate need.
Gar, in New York, one of the things that I'm particularly familiar with is efforts which went from sweat equity in using one's labor to renovate, at that time, abandoned properties. And eventually, as the renovation took place, they were legitimized by the municipality and they became low-income co-ops with both the policy graces and some resources from the city government. But invariably, the reality was that if somebody became ill, if somebody became sickly, lost their wage, and so on, the cooperative would act just as any landlord would. They would take them to court and seek their eviction. So in the long run, the boards themselves became very petty, very bureaucratized, and it functioned in a way that was hardly democratic, either economically or morally. So I looked at that versus the issue, for example, of public housing, which is, you know, housing in the public domain. People need shelter. So I'm trying to understand just the benefit of co-op rather than state-owned properties with worker boards and so on.
Well, there's a lot of questions in there, including the ones between a productive co-op, like a worker-owned factory or this laundry, or there's a big laundry here as well, by the way, a very ecologically green laundry. It's used about a third the water. The difference between that and a housing co-op or a public enterprise. The starting point of the argument, maybe I could frame it this way, is that 1% of the United States population owns just under 50% of the investment capital. 5% owns 70%. That's the power system underneath corporate capitalism. And so the principle is you've got to change who owns capital at some point in one form or another, or you're not going to change the power structure. And we could go into that discussion. But when you begin to look at it, is there a way to do it that builds up a radically decentralized form moving towards public ownership, but only at levels that are necessary? So starting with co-ops and worker-owned companies, many of which are different from what you said, many of which in practice have turned out to be highly participatory. The ones in Cleveland draw on the Mondragon experience in the Basque Country of Spain. I don't know if people are aware of that. That's a huge co-op that's got an enormous amount of interest lately because it's high-tech, advanced research, production in many different fields, 100,000 people, participatory operation, extremely participatory, and with wage structures in most parts of the company at 5-to-1 rather than 250-to-1, and in a very small part of the biggest part of them, 8-to-1 top to bottom rather than 250-to-1. And they have developed a culture of real participation that is studied by many people, particularly not only progressives, but people who are interested from all different avenues. That's one of the elements that we're trying to see, and we're beginning to see people trying to do in these worker co-ops, build up a culture of participation. None of this works without building up a different culture. That if you just, you know, stick worker ownership on and call it a legal form, it often doesn't mean much. It does mean that people own and may, in fact, get the benefits that would have gone to the private guy who invested. But the participatory aspect has to be developed in a cultural way that people need to really get into it.
Gar, I wanted to just move the discussion because there are other facets of public ownership and ownership by the 99% that you do mention in the book. And one of them is what used to be called municipal socialism or municipal ownership. And you make a number of different examples of ownership so we don't normally associate with municipal or state government, such as ownership of internet companies and cable companies and indeed banks. And I'm wondering if there are others that we don't normally associate with such governments and what the potentials of those are.
That's a really good question, because at one level you've got the worker co-ops that are developing and neighborhood corporations. Another level are, you know, 25% of American electricity today, even now, draws on that municipal socialist tradition. It comes out of municipally owned utilities and electric co-ops. And there are electric providing internet. There's 300 or 400 cities that are doing city-owned internet. And there are state banks like the Bank of North Dakota, which is a state bank. There are about 15 states trying to set that up in other states. Some cities, San Francisco and Portland, Oregon in particular, have been noticed lately. City's got $2 billion in cash. Why should it put it in Bank of America? Why not set up a city bank or a city credit union? So this is another sign of the developing democratization process that's going on at different levels in different states. Healthcare is another one. That is, there are about 15 states that are looking at single-payer healthcare, which is another form of public ownership of a public insurance company, if you like. So that's the process you're seeing develop, and I think that's the precondition of a democratization. I'm a historian, and I think of these in decades. There took several decades of development at the state and local level before you got to the real progressive era, before you got to the New Deal. And I think before you get to a real democratization of capital, this is the kind of buildup that's got to happen. And I think it is happening because of the pain levels that are developing. And when it takes on a political form, which it has taken on in a few states, but has only beginning to take on a political demand as well as experimentation, a lot of the experimentation we're talking about, then I think it really gets interesting at the grassroots and the local, municipal, and then the state level. If we have time, we can talk about some of the national possibilities that are emerging too.
Well, one of the things that I was also interested in was you do not focus on what has been a common cry here, and certainly Ken and I have raised it enough, which is things such as a millionaire's tax and really the emphasis on progressive taxation. Again, you move in the direction of the transformative process being more within the composition of cooperatives. Could you talk more about that?
Well, the book, America Beyond Capitalism, actually has a long, long chapter. I was a little bit ahead of the game. The first edition was out in 2005, and I didn't say the 99%. I said the 98%. I was 1 point off.
Shame on you, yes.
But I argued that that's the place to draw the line politically, because people would realize that the numbers really are highly concentrated in the top 1% to 2%. But so there is a whole – I'm not – this book is not against any of that. In fact, it's part and parcel of the same argument. How do we focus the discussion really on the top and also build up institutions that are taking on new forms of democratized ownership, including national? That is to say, I think when the next big banking crisis hits, and experts left, right, and center know there's going to be another big banking crisis. Regulation is not possible anymore given the political power structure. So at some point they'll probably try to break them up, and then we know they're going to regroup. The big fish will eat the little fish, and they'll be back at the trough. At some point, the only answer really is public ownership of the big banks. I think that's on the horizon as well.
I think we also missed an opportunity with GM when that was in receivership, and also Citibank.
Absolutely.
You know,
we nationalized Chrysler and GM.
The demand could have gone on there.
Yeah, we nationalized two big auto companies, put in a lot of taxpayer money, and then gave them away basically after taking the cost. Those could very well have been kept. The profits could have gone to the public. We could have started making mass transit vehicles and high-speed rail. But we did nationalize because of the crisis, and I think we're going to see more of that in different industries at that level. But my concern is how we build up a really democratic form of changing ownership that starts at the bottom up rather than kind of ending with statism and state-owned ownership, which turns out often to be very undemocratic and, you know, dangerous to liberty.
Gee whiz, I just want to push that again a little bit, you know, just experientially, my own sense, again, going back to things such as public housing. There certainly were complaints that housing deteriorated when housing was in REM, was taken over by the municipality. But it was always my perspective that politically one could challenge the government, and that there's the kind of embryonic consciousness that is built up by the function and the role of government, and government there to serve us, so that housing, if you will, in the public domain, etc., was a far more progressive response to accomplishing low-income housing than, again, trying to build clusters of cooperative administration and units.
Well, the argument here, I mean, I think if you go to the housing sector in a corporate capitalist system, it's always going to be squeezed out, and you're going to beg for trying to get the government to provide public housing. The notion of really transforming the ownership of wealth and income is radical redistribution throughout the system. So some parts of it ought to be in co-ops. The question is to really define where, and some parts of it certainly should be public. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we can draw that line without a huge amount of development experimentation in the cities and states. And I think that's what's happening. The press doesn't cover any of this. The press isn't interested, and they probably don't have the resources. But there is a massive, that's what the book's about, America Beyond Capitalism. There's a massive amount going on that simply isn't being covered. And it points in the direction, really, of a radically different system, not just experiments. And that's the really interesting question, whether or not some of these principles over time, and as I say, building up step by step, decade by decade as the pain goes on, begin to give us a vision of where we want to go that's different from corporate capitalism or state-run socialism. It's a different format of the next system. So we don't know if we'll get there, but almost all of it's positive in any case, so it's useful to do. But it begins to, in a Gramscian sense, crack through the hegemonic ideas that say there's only this direction that's possible. No, there are other directions, and indeed Americans are doing it in a pretty interesting way if you look just below the surface.
And it does seem as if right now, because of the continuing failures of the current system, that people, and especially the young, are looking for new ideas, whether they be those that are statist, state control of reduction resources, or cooperatives or other new ideas. But people are fed up with what we have right now.
Exactly. And I think that's what's the other piece of this. This is coming largely out of pain and experimentation because nothing's working. But there's at a whole other level, there's a moral and ideological crisis going on that people know there's something fundamentally wrong. And that's a big deal in history when that moment arises. And that's what Occupy has been so powerful about. Those are coming together. I think these are important in terms of the idea systems and the politics as well as the experimentation.
Gar, if you could talk about your concept of pluralist commonwealth. You talk about moving beyond state socialism. There's an inherent critique in that, but what is pluralistic commonwealth? How would you suggest, which I should tell people, you must read the book because it's replete with example, ideological and practical, but for our listeners, how would you capsulize that concept?
That's the heart of the book. I mean, the argument, the question about systemic organization in capitalism, corporate capitalism, free enterprise capitalism, state socialism, there's a whole tradition in the socialist tradition, which was libertarian socialism, communitarian socialism, and a wide range of attempts to figure out how you, knowing that ownership of capital was central, right, that's where the power rested. The name of that book, after all, was Capital. All about that question is really, and indeed conservatives have the same view. They believe capital is the defining characteristic and it ought to be kept in the private sector. But if you put it in the state, I think the conservatives and the libertarian socialists and the communitarian socialists and the anarchists were right. That over-concentration of political and economic power is dangerous. Well, still, if you need to have it democratized, then the principle, of subsidiarity, the Catholic theological social democratic principle was subsidiarity. Go to the smallest level possible and only go up one level if necessary and work your way up to the top each time only when absolutely necessary. And that's really the principle here. I don't think it's a great phrase. I call it a pluralist commonwealth because it includes some public ownership, national ownership. We just talked about possibilities. It includes some state ownership. It has some city municipal ownership, a great deal of worker co-ops and worker ownership and neighborhood ownership, plural forms of democratizing ownership so as to break up the power complex, but also so as to give people direct personal experience in the democratic process of handling capital. That vision that people actually can take charge and learn and become democratically controlling things, if you don't have that at the grassroots level, you're never going to have a democratic system at the national level. So I take the old argument, really, from Tocqueville and John Stuart Mill and numerous theorists. If you can't build direct, real experience at the local level in democratic practice, and that doesn't mean just voting. That means actually doing it and controlling it and coming up with ideas, an active, engaged democratic process. If you can't build that culture, you're not going to have it at the national level, inevitably. So that's the theme of what I call the pluralist commonwealth and in America Beyond Capitalism. How do we build that format and the direction we want to take?
Well, Noam Chomsky said it's a marvelous book. I recommend it all the time. And so do Ken and I. That's why we had on Gar Alperovitz, America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. And you too can get involved in these really critical conversations, not just on an intellectual level, but to put into practical use for the next stage of occupying Wall Street. We need some solutions.
And we need to go beyond capitalism.
Right, and there's great ideas. And
thank you
very much for your contribution.
Thank you.
And for being with us.
Thank you.
Again, we've been speaking with Gar Alperovitz, and the book is America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy.
Evergreen Cooperatives is a network of employee-owned businesses. We are looking at a new paradigm for creating wealth in the Cleveland community. We will create a network of for-profit businesses that will hire from the neighborhoods, and the employees will own the businesses that are created.
It can't be just another initiative. I think for all of us, we want this to have meaning and scale and to be transformative. And it's just that simple.
This is more than a job. This is an ownership opportunity.
Having people able to participate in the creation and access to wealth that would normally be excluded is really the best part of this.
I envision being one of the owners to make the decisions about Evergreen and expanding.
That roots these projects in the community long term.
This is opportunity program. You know, this is not me getting back into a work habit or something like that. This is opportunity for me to get ahead.
It isn't just a job. It is their future long term. And we think that can really help bring about some positive change in the neighborhood.
I had some good people out there that believed in me, and they gave me a second chance. And so I can plan for my future now.
They're really willing to put the hard work necessary to make a difference in their own lives and the lives of their families.
They're revitalizing their neighborhood and taking ownership of their future.
We are investing through our purchase of services in the employees who will end up owning the businesses.
Over the next 3 to 4 years, we think we can create somewhere 500, 600 jobs in these low-income neighborhoods of Greater University Circle.
What we're doing is catalyzing something. We're catalyzing, you know, a whole new grouping of companies.
In order for people to be truly vested in their community, they have to have ownership in the community. And ownership requires wealth.
That's not construction, that's not salaries of their staff, that is to purchase food, it's to outsource housekeeping, those that do that, and it's for things like laundry.
We're market-driven, but instead of being investor-driven as well, we're worker-owner-driven. We determine pretty accurately that there's 250 million pounds of healthcare bed linens available annually.
With recent legislation, Ohio has a mandate
to create 60 megs of solar generating capacity in the year 2012. And right now there's two.
We're targeting several megawatts over the next couple of years, and you know, that's on the order of nothing that's been done in Ohio to date.
It's going to be a great day to be knowing that we are helping to generate some power in a clean, environmentally responsible way.
We're talking about a 5.5-acre greenhouse that will produce about 5 to 6 million heads of lettuce annually and another 300,000 pounds of herbs annually.
The only way that the employees will generate any personal wealth is from the business being profitable.
The bottom line is we still have to produce a quality product, we have to keep our customers happy, and we have to continue to gain revenue.
This is a laboratory for a new kind of economic development.
It's actually a career, which is one of the reasons that I wanted to be involved with it, because it's not just a job.
This is different. It is higher risk. It's not based upon the social service model, but the business model and the co-op ownership model.
It could serve as a model, not just here, but other places in the same way it helped in Spain. It could be that here, too.
It offers a bootstrap strategy for pulling yourself up with your own resources.
As this company expands, so do your wealth.
Less than a week time, I learned how to run everything in here, and also teach other people what I've learned.
You know, we're not asking for dollars to stop at one company or two companies. If we can keep going to 20 and 30 companies and get to the scale that they experienced in Mondragon, that's, I think, one definition of success.
In 5 years, where this is going to go, I think most cities is going to jump on or want to look at what we're doing here and use us as a model.
Cleveland wants to be where the world is going, not where the world is.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.